In deference to the civilians, the trip was at 1.2 G. Rod suffered through innumerable dinner parties, mediated arguments between scientists and crew, and fended off attempts by Dr. Buckman, the astrophysicist, to monopolize Sally's time. First jump was routine. The transfer point to Murchison's Eye was well located. New Caledonia was a magnificent white point source in the moment before MacArthur jumped. Then, Murchison's Eye was a wide red glare, the size of a baseball held at arm's length. The fleet moved inward. Gavin Potter had traded hammocks with Horst Staley. It had cost him a week's labor doing two men's laundry, but it had been worth it. Staley's hammock had a viewport. Naturally, the port was beneath the hammock in the cylindrical spin floor of the gunroom. Potter lay face down in the hammock to look through the webbing, a gentle smile on his long face. Whitbread was face up in his own hammock directly across the spin floor from Potter. He had been watching Potter for several minutes before he spoke. "Mr. Potter." The new Scot turned only his head. "Yes, Mr. Whitbread." Whitbread continued to watch him, contemplatively, with his arms folded behind his head. He was quite aware that Potter's infatuation with Murchison's Eye was none of his damned business. Incomprehensible, Potter remained polite. How much needling would he take? Entertaining things were happening aboard MacArthur, but there was no way for midshipmen to get to them. An off-duty middy must make his own entertainment. "Potter, I seem to remember you were transferred aboard Old Mac on Dagda just before we went to pick up the probe." Whitbread's voice was a carrying one. Horst Staley, who was also off-duty, turned over in what had been Potter's bunk and gave them his attention. Whitbread noticed without seeming to. Potter turned and blinked. "Yes, Mr. Whitbread, that's right."
"Well, somebody has to tell you, and I don't suppose anyone else has thought of it. Your first shipboard mission involved diving right into an F-8 Sun. I hope it hasn't given you a bad impression of the service."
"Not at all. I found it exciting," Potter said courteously.
"The point is, diving straight into a Sun is a rare thing in the service. It doesn't happen every trip. I thought someone ought to tell you."
"But, Mr. Whitbread, are we not about to do exactly that?"
"Huh?"
Whitbread hadn't expected that.
"No ship of the First Empire ever found a transfer point from Murchison's Eye to the moat. They may no have wanted it badly, but we can assume they tried somewhat," Potter said seriously. "Now, I have had very little experience in space, but I am not uneducated, Mr. Whitbread. Murchison's Eye is a red supergiant, a big empty star, as big as the orbit of Saturn in Sol system. It seems reasonable that the Alderson point to the moat is within yon star if it exists. Does it not?"
Horst Staley rose up on an elbow.
"I think he's right. It would explain why nobody ever plotted the transfer point. They all knew where it was. But nobody wanted to go look." "Yes, of course he's right," Whitbread said in disgust. "And that's just where we're going.
Whee! Here we go again."
"Exactly," said Potter, and smiling gently, he turned on his face again.
"It's most unusual," Whitbread protested. "Doubt me if you must, but I assure you we don't go diving into stars more than 2 out of 3 trips." He paused. "And even that's too many."
The fleet slowed to a halt at the fuzzy edge of Murchison's Eye. There was no question of orbits. At this distance, the supergiant's gravity was so feeble that it would have taken years for a ship to fall into it. The tankers linked up and began to transfer fuel. An odd, tenuous friendship had grown between Horace Berry and Buckman, the astrophysicist. Berry had sometimes wondered about it. What did Buckman want with Berry? Buckman was a lean, knobby, bird-boned man. From the look of him, he sometimes forgot to eat for days at a time. Buckman seemed to care for nobody and nothing in what Berry considered the real universe. People, time, power, money were only the means Buckman used to explore the inner workings of the stars. Why would he seek the company of a merchant?
but Buckman liked to talk, and Barry at least had the time to listen. MacArthur was a beehive these days, frantically busy and crowded as hell. And there was room to pace in Barry's cabin. Or, Barry speculated cynically, he might like Barry's coffee. Barry had almost a dozen varieties of coffee beans, his own grinder and filter cones to make it. He was quite aware of how his coffee compared with that in the huge percolators about the ship. Nabil served them coffee while they watched the fuel transfer on Barry's screen. The tanker fueling MacArthur was hidden, but Lennon and the other tanker showed as two space-black elongated eggs, linked by a silver umbilicus, silhouetted against a backdrop of fuzzy scarlet. "It should not be that dangerous," said Dr. Buckman. "You're thinking of it as a descent into a sunbury, which it is, technically. But that whole vast volume isn't all that much more massive than Cal, or any other yellow dwarf. Think of it as a red-hot vacuum, except for the core, of course. That's probably tiny and very dense." "We'll learn a great deal going in," he said. His eyes were alight, focused on infinity. Barry, watching him sidewise, found the expression fascinating. He had seen it before, but rarely. It marked men who could not be bought in any coin available to Horace Barry. Barry had no more practical use for Buckman than Buckman had for Barry. Barry could relax with Buckman, as much as he could relax with anybody. He liked the feeling. He said, "I thought you would already know everything about the Eye." "You mean Murchison's explorations?" "Too many records have been lost, and some of the others aren't trustworthy. I've had my instruments going since the jump. Barry, the proportion of heavy particles in the solar wind is amazingly high, and helium, tremendous. But Murchison's ships never went into the Eye itself, as far as we know. That's when we'll really learn things." Buckman frowned. "I hope our instruments can stand up to it. They have to poke through the Langston field, of course. We're likely to be down in that red-hot fog for some considerable time, Barry. If the field collapses, it'll ruin everything." Barry stared, then laughed. "Yes, Doctor, it certainly would." Buckman looked puzzled. Then, "Ah, I see what you mean. It would kill us, too, wouldn't it? I hadn't thought of that." Acceleration warnings sounded. MacArthur was moving into the Eye. Sinclair's thick burr sounded in Rod's ear.
"Engineering report, Captain. All systems green. Field holding very well. 'Tis nae so warm as we feared."
"Good," Blaine replied. "Thanks, Sandy."
Rod watched the tankers receding against the stars. Already they were thousands of kilometers away, visible only through the telescopes as bright as points of light. The next screen showed a white splotch within a red fog, Lennon leading into the universal red glare. Lennon's crew would search for the Alderson point, if there were such a point.
"Still, 'tis certain the field will leak inward sooner or later," Sinclair's voice continued. "There's no place for the heat to go. It must be stored. 'Tis no like a space battle, Captain. But we can hold with no place to radiate the accumulated energy for at least 72 hours. After that, we have no data. No one has tried this loony stunt before."
"Yes."
"Somebody should have,"
Renner said cheerfully. He had been listening from his post on the bridge. MacArthur was holding at 1G, but it took attention. The thin photosphere was presenting more resistance than expected.
"You'd think Murchison would have tried it. The First Empire had better ships than ours."
"Maybe he did," Rod said absently. He watched Lennon move away, breaking trail for MacArthur, and felt an unreasonable irritation. MacArthur should have gone first. The senior officers slept at their duty stations. There wasn't much anyone could do if the field soaked up too much energy, but Rod felt better in his command seat. Finally, it was obvious that he wasn't needed. A signal came from Lennon, and MacArthur cut her engines. Warning horns sounded, and she came under spin until other hoots signaled the end of unpleasant changes in gravity. Crew and passengers climbed out of safety rigging. "Dismiss the watch below," Rod ordered. Renner stood and stretched elaborately.
"That's that, Captain. Of course, we'll have to slow down as the photosphere gets thicker, but that's all right. The friction slows us down anyway."
He looked at his screens and asked questions with swiftly moving fingers.
"It's not as thick as, say, an atmosphere out there, but it's a lot thicker than a solar wind."
Blaine could see that for himself. Lennon was still ahead, at the outer limit of detection, and her engines were off. She was a black splinter in the screens, her outlines blurred by 4,000 kilometers of red hot fog. The eye thickened around them. Rod stayed on the bridge another hour, then persuaded himself that he was being unfair.
"Mr. Renner?"
"Yes, sir."
"You can go off watch now. Let Mr. Crawford take her."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Renner headed for his cabin. He'd reached the conclusion that he wasn't needed on the bridge 58 minutes before. Now for a hot shower and some sleep in his bunk instead of the conning chair. The companionway to his cabin was jammed as usual. Kevin Renner was pushing his way through with single-minded determination when someone lurched hard against him.
"Damn it! Excuse me!" he snarled.
He watched the miscreant regain his feet by hanging onto the lapels of Renner's uniform.
"Dr. Horvath, isn't it?"
"My apologies."
The science minister stepped back and brushed at himself ineffectually.
"I haven't gotten used to spin gravity yet. None of us have. It's the Coriolis effect that throws us off."
"No, it's the elbows," Renner said.
He regained his habitual grin.
"There are 6 times as many elbows as people aboard this ship, Doctor. I've been counting."
"Very funny. Mr. Renner, isn't it? Sailing Master Renner? Renner, this crowding bothers my personnel as much as yours. If we could stay out of your way, we would. But we can't. The data on the eye have to be collected. We may never have such a chance again."
"I know, Doctor, and I sympathize. Now, if you'll—"
Visions of hot water and clean bedding receded as Horvath clutched at his lapels again. "Just a moment, please." Horvath seemed to be making up his mind about something. "Mr. Renner, you were aboard MacArthur when she captured the alien probe, weren't you?"
"Hoo boy, I sure was."
"I'd like to talk to you."
"Now? But, Doctor, the ship may need my attention at any moment."
"I consider it urgent."
"But we're cruising through the photosphere of a star, as you may have noticed."
"And I haven't had a hot shower in 3 days, as you may also have noticed."
Renner took a second look at Horvath's expression and gave up.
"All right, Doctor, only let's get out of the passageway."
Horvath's cabin was as cramped as anything on board, except that it had walls. More than half of MacArthur's crew would have considered those walls an undeserved luxury. Horvath apparently did not, from the look of disgust and the muttered apologies as they entered the cabin. He lifted the bunk into the bulkhead and dropped 2 chairs from the opposite wall.
"Sit down, Renner. There are things about that interception that have been bothering me. I hope I can get an unbiased view from you. You're not a regular Navy man."
The sailing master did not bother to deny it. He had been mate on a merchant ship before and would skipper one when he left the Navy with his increased experience, and he could hardly wait to return to the merchant service. "So," said Horvath, and sat down on the very edge of the fold-out chair. "Renner, was it absolutely necessary to attack the probe?" Renner started to laugh. Horvath took it, though he looked as if he had eaten a bad oyster.
"All right," said Renner. "I shouldn't have laughed."
"You weren't there. Did you know the probe was diving into Cal for maximum deceleration?"
"Certainly, and I appreciate that you were too. But was it really that dangerous?"
"Dr. Horvath, the captain surprised me twice. Utterly. When the probe attacked, I was trying to take us around the edge of the sail before we were cooked. Maybe I'd have got us away in time, and maybe not. But the captain took us through the sail.
It was brilliant. It was something I should have thought of, and I happen to think the man's a genius. He's also a suicidal maniac."
"What?"
On Renner's face was retrospective dread. He should never have tried to pick up the probe. We'd lost too much time. We were about to ram a star. I wouldn't have believed we could pick up the damned thing so fast. Blaine did that himself?
No.
He gave the job to Cargill, who's better at tight high-grav maneuvers than anybody else aboard. That's the point, Doctor. The captain picked the best man for the job and got out of the way.
And you would have run for it? Forthrightly and without embarrassment.
But he picked it up.
Well, Horvath seemed to taste something bad.
But he also fired on it. The first...
It shot first. That was a meteor defense.
So what?
Horvath clamped his lips.
All right, Doctor, try this. Suppose you left your car on a hill with the brakes off and the wheels turned the wrong way. And suppose it rolled down the hill and killed four people. What's your ethical position?
Terrible.
Make your point, Renner. The Motis are at least as intelligent as we are. Granted, okay, they built a meteor defense. They had an obligation to see to it that it did not fire on neutral spacecraft.
Horvath sat there for what seemed a long time, while Kevin Renner thought about the limited capacity of the hot water tanks in officers' country. That bad taste expression was natural to Horvath, Renner saw. The lines in his face fell into it naturally and readily. Finally, the science minister said,
"Thank you, Mr. Renner."
"You're welcome." Renner stood. An alarm sounded. "Oh, Lord, that's me." Renner dashed for the bridge. They were deep within the eye, deep enough that the thin star stuff around them showed yellow. The field indicators showed yellow, too, but with a tinge of green. All this Renner saw as he glanced around at half a dozen screens on the bridge. He looked at the plots on his own screens, and he did not see the battleship.
"Lenin's jumped?"
"Right," Midshipman Whitbread said. "We're next, sir." The red-haired middy's grin seemed to meet at the back of his head. Blaine sailed into the bridge without touching the companionway sides.
"Take the con, Mr. Renner. The pilot ought to be at your station now."
"Aye, aye, sir." Renner turned to Whitbread.
"I relieve you."
His fingers danced across the input keys. Then he hit a line of buttons, even as the new data flowed onto his screen. Alarms went off in rapid succession.
"Jump stations, battle stations, heavy acceleration warning."
MacArthur prepared herself for the unknown. Part 2. The Crazy Eddy Point. 13. Look around you. She was the first to find the intruders. She had been exploring a shapeless mass of stony asteroid that turned out to be mostly empty space. Some earlier culture had carved out rooms and nooks and tankages and storage chambers, then fused the detritus into more rooms and chambers, until the mass was a stone beehive. It had all happened very long ago, but that was of no interest to her. In later ages, meteoroids had made dozens of holes through the construct. Thick walls had been gradually thinned so that air might be chemically extracted from the stone. There was no air now. There was no metal anywhere. Dry mummies and stone, stone. Little else and nothing at all for an engineer. She left via a meteoroid puncture, for all the airlocks had been fused shut by vacuum welding. A long time after that, someone had removed their metal working parts. After she was outside, she saw them, very far away, a tiny glimmer of golden light against the coal sack. It was worth a look. Anything was worth a look. The engineer returned to her ship. Telescope and spectrometer failed her at first. There were two of the golden slivers, and some bulk inside each of them, but something was shutting out her view of the masses inside. Patiently, the engineer went to work on her instruments, redesigning, recalibrating, rebuilding, her hands working at blinding speed, guided by a thousand cycles of instincts. There were force fields to be penetrated.
Presently, she had something that would do that. Not well, but she could see large objects. She looked again. Metal. Endless, endless metal. She took off immediately. The call of treasure was not to be ignored. There was little of free will in an engineer. Blaine watched a flurry of activity through a red fog as he fought to regain control of his traitor body after it turned to normal space. An all-clear signal flashed from Lennon, and Rod breathed more easily. Nothing threatened, and he could enjoy the view. It was the eye he saw first. Murkison's eye was a tremendous ruby, brighter than 100 full moons, all alone on the black velvet of the coal sack. On the other side of the sky, the moat was the brightest of a sea of stars. All systems looked this way at breakout, a lot of stars, and one distant sun. To starboard was a splinter of light, Lennon, her Langston field radiating the overload picked up in the eye. Admiral Kutyasov made one final check and signaled Blaine again. Until something threatened, the scientists aboard MacArthur were in charge. Rod ordered coffee and waited for information. At first, there was maddeningly little that he hadn't already known. The moat was only 35 light-years from New Scotland, and there had been a number of observations, some dating back to Jasper Murkison himself. A G2 star, less energetic than Sol, cooler, smaller, and a bit less massive. It showed almost no sunspot activity at the moment, and the astrophysicists found it dull. Rod had known about the gas giant before they started. Early astronomers had deduced it from perturbations in the moat's orbit around the eye. They knew the gas giant planet's mass, and they found it almost where they expected, 70 degrees around from them. Heavier than Jupiter, but smaller, much denser, with a degenerate matter core. While the scientists worked, the Navy men plotted courses to the gas giant, in case one or the other warship should need to refuel. Scooping up hydrogen by ramming through a gas giant's atmosphere on a hyperbolic orbit was hard on ships and crew, but a lot better than being stranded in an alien system. "We're searching out the Trojan points now, Captain," Buckman told Rod, 2 hours after breakout. "Any sign of the moat planet?" "Not yet." Buckman hung up. Why was Buckman concerned with Trojan points? 60 degrees ahead of the giant planet in its orbit, and 60 degrees behind would be 2 points of stable equilibrium, called Trojan points, after the Trojan asteroids that occupy similar points in Jupiter's orbit. Over millions of years, they ought to have collected dust clouds and clusters of asteroids. But why would Buckman bother with these? Buckman called again when he found the Trojans. "They're packed," Buckman gloated. "Either this whole system is cluttered with asteroids from edge to edge, or there's a new principle at work. There's more junk in Moat Beta's Trojans than has ever been reported in another system. It's a wonder they haven't all collected to form a pair of moons." "Have you found the habitable planet yet?" "Not yet," said Buckman, and faded off the screen. That was 3 hours after breakout. He called back half an hour later. "Those Trojan Point asteroids have very high albedos, Captain. They must be thick with dust. That might explain how so many of the larger particles were captured. The dust clouds slow them down, then polish them smooth." "Dr. Buckman, there is an inhabited world in this system, and it is vital that we find it. These are the first intelligent aliens—" "Damn it, Captain, we're looking, we're looking!" Buckman glanced to one side, then withdrew. The screen was blank for a moment, showing only a badly focused shot of a technician in the background. Blaine found himself confronting Science Minister Horvath, who said, "Please excuse the interruption, Captain. Do I understand you are not satisfied with our search methods?" "Dr. Horvath, I have no wish to intrude on your prerogatives, but you've taken over all my instruments, and I keep hearing about asteroids. I wonder if we're all looking for the same thing." Horvath's reply was mild. "This is not a space battle, Captain." He paused. "In a war operation, you would know your target."
you would probably know the ephemeris of the planets in any system of interest. Hell, survey teams find planets.
Ever been on one, Captain?
No.
Well, think about the problem we face. Until we located the gas giant and the Trojan asteroids, we weren't precise about the plane of the system. From the probe's instruments, we have deduced the temperature the Motis find comfortable, and from that, we deduce how far from their sun their planet should be. And we still must search out a toroid 120 million kilometers in radius. Do you follow me?
Blaine nodded.
We're going to have to search that entire region. We know the planet isn't hidden behind the sun, because we're above the plane of the system. But when we finish photographing the system, we have to examine this enormous star field for the one dot of light we want.
Perhaps I was expecting too much.
Perhaps. We're all waiting as fast as we can.
He smiled, a spasm that lifted his whole face for a split second, and vanished.
6 hours after breakout, Horvath reported again. There was no sign of Buckman.
No, Captain, we haven't found the inhabited planet, but Dr. Buckman's time-wasting observations have identified a Moti civilization in the Trojan points.
They're inhabited?
Definitely. Both Trojan points are seething with microwave frequencies. We should have guessed from the high albedos of the larger bodies. Polished surfaces are a natural product of civilization. I'm afraid Dr. Buckman's people think too much in terms of a dead universe.
Thank you, Doctor. Is any of that message traffic for us?
I don't think so, Captain. But the nearest Trojan point is below us in this system's plane, about 3 million kilometers away. I suggest we go there. From the apparent density of civilization in the Trojan points, it may be that the inhabited planet is not the real nexus of Moti civilization. Perhaps it is like Earth, or worse.
Rod was shocked. He had found Earth herself shocking, not all that many years ago. New Annapolis was kept on Manhome, so that Imperial officers would know just how vital was the great task of the Empire. And if men had not had the Alderson drive before Earth's last battles, and the nearest star had been 35 light-years away instead of 4, that's a horrible thought.
I agree. It's only a guess, Captain. But in any event, there is a viable civilization nearby, and I think we should go to it.
Just a moment. Chief Yeoman Lute Shattuck was at the bridge companionway, gesturing frantically at Rod's number 4 screen.
We used the message-sending locator scopes, Skipper, Shattuck shouted across the bridge. Look, sir!
The screen showed black space with pinhole dots of stars and a blue-green point circled by an indicator light ring. As Rod watched, the point blinked twice.
We've found the inhabited planet, Rod said with satisfaction. He couldn't resist. We beat you to it, Doctor.
After all the waiting, it was as if everything broke at once. The light was first. There might have been an Earth-like world behind it. There probably was, for it was in the donut locus Horvath was searching. But the light hid whatever was behind it, and it wasn't surprising that the communications people had found it first. Watching for signals was their job. Cargill and Horvath's team worked together to answer the pulses. 1, 2, 3, 4, blinked the light. And Cargill used the forward batteries to send 5, 6, 7. 20 minutes later, the light sent 3, 1, 8, 4, 11, repeated, and the ship's brain ground out pi base 12. Cargill used the computer to find E to the same base, and replied with that. But the true message was, we want to talk to you. And MacArthur's answer was, fine. Elaborations would have to wait. And the second development was already in.
Fusion light, said Sailing Master Renner.
He bent close over his screen. His fingers played strange, silent music on his control board.
No Langston field, naturally. They're just enclosing the hydrogen, fusing it and blasting it out. A plasma bottle. It's not as hot as our drives, which means lower efficiency. Red shift, if I'm reading the impurities right. It must be aimed away from us.
You think it's a ship coming to meet us?
Yes, sir. A small one. Give us a few minutes and I'll tell you its acceleration. Meanwhile, we assume an acceleration of 1G. Renner's fingers had been tapping all the while. And get a mass of 30 tons. Later we'll readjust that.
Too big to be a missile, Blaine said thoughtfully. Should we meet him halfway, Mr. Renner?
Renner frowned. There's a problem. He's aiming at where we are now. We don't know how much fuel he's got or how bright he is.
Let's ask anyway. Eyes, get me Admiral Kutyusov.
The Admiral was on his bridge. Blurs out of focus behind him showed activity aboard Lenin.
I've seen it, Captain, Kutyusov said. What do you want to do about it?
I want to go meet that ship. But in case it can't change course or we can't catch it, it will come here, sir.
Lenin could wait for it.
And do what, Captain?
My instructions are clear. Lenin is to have nothing to do with aliens.
But you could send out a boat, sir. A gig, which we'll pick up with your men.
Sir.
How many boats do you think I have, Blaine?
Let me repeat my instructions. Lenin is here to protect secret of Alderson Drive and Langston Field. To accomplish task, we will not only not communicate with aliens, we will not communicate with you when message might be intercepted.
Yes, sir.
Blaine stared at the burly man on the screen.
Didn't he have a shred of curiosity? Nobody could be that much of a machine. Or could he?
We'll go to the alien ship, sir. Dr. Horvath wants to anyway.
Very good, Captain. Carry on.
Yes, sir. Rod cut off the screen with relief, then turned to Renner.
Let's go make first contact with an alien, Mr. Renner.
I think you just did that, said Renner. He glanced nervously at the screens to be sure the Admiral was gone.